The Weighing Machine was created to help you, the financial advisor or investor, reach your long-term financial goals. Each episode, your hosts, Rusty Vanneman and I, Robin Murray, cut through the market clamor to find the time-tested principles that help investors succeed.
The Weighing Machine is inspired by the classic investing truism attributed to Benjamin Graham. The stock market is a voting machine in the short run and a weighing machine over the long term. In other words, emotion drives short-term market movement, but fundamentals and valuations drive returns over time.
Welcome to The Weighing Machine.
Enjoy, and as always, let us know what you think.
On the podcast today, it's award season. We'll present the best sectors, regions, styles, and industries of 2019. We'll also talk about the courage it takes to be different and changes to this podcast.
And we will also discuss the three pillars of Orion's new direct indexing offering. And we'll also talk about the new Orion due diligence team. That will be with Orion's Director of Investment Due Diligence, Shana Sissel. Plus, my interview is with Portfolio Manager and Chief Executive Officer, Phil Taze from the Taze Corporation. Welcome to The Weighing Machine. I'm Rusty Vanneman.
And I'm Robin Murray. Okay, let's start with a look at the markets. Let's focus on sentiment today. How are investors feeling out there?
All right, well, so great question. We're off to another one. I mean, it feels like every time we do the podcast, we're saying the same thing, and that is the markets are off to a great start, and if you're in globally diversified portfolios, you're doing well. One thing that is a little bit different than last year is, at least at the end of last year, is that there's been kind of a resumption of where growth stocks are outperforming value stocks as the dollar is getting stronger here in recent weeks. And also because of the coronavirus scare, emerging markets have taken a step backwards. But when it comes to investor sentiment, a couple of things stand out, and I think it is important to review sentiment at the beginning of these podcasts, because as investors and advisors, we need to be aware, of course, that over the short term, the market is often driven by emotion. But what's also really interesting about investor sentiment is that when sentiment gets really strong one way or the other, so for instance, if people become really, really bullish and think the market is going to continue moving higher, it is remarkable that generally speaking, the market moves the opposite direction over the next 1 month, 3 months, 6 months, 12 months. And so, and obviously the reverse, if people are really, really negative, the market generally does well. And so it's just important to remember that if the news and the current narrative sounds kind of scary, it's probably a better time to buy. And if everybody is making it sound like it's just all roses out there, it's probably, you probably should wait a little bit. And so it's just best to stay balanced, of course.
All right. Well,
oh, hold it. Yes. That didn't even answer your question. I'm so sorry. So I just did that whole preamble why we think sentiment's important. Mm-hmm. And so so currently the current sentiment readings, which are important, is first of all, when it comes to the stock market, there is an incredible mixed read right now. When you look at sentiment surveys, investors are bullish. However, when you look at what people are actually doing with their money, they are remarkably still buying fixed income assets way more than they're buying equity funds, which suggests that they may be saying they're bullish, but they're really not. The other thing that's really interesting is that we look at sentiment on the dollar. The dollar sentiment right now would suggest the dollar is going to get weaker. And if the fact the dollar does get weaker, that would suggest international markets should do better, which suggests real assets would do better. And in fact, when we look at sentiment for commodities right now, that would suggest that we'll see more gains in the commodity complex. I say more gains, though commodities are down on the year. But sentiment is actually would suggest that we'll see more gains there. And so anyway, those are some of the interesting reads. And it just always amazes me how much investors love fixed income right now, despite the really low interest rates.
You done?
I think I'm done. Yeah, okay. I know.
All right. Well, I do want to talk about a little bit of reformatting that's happening here on the podcast, just so our listeners know what's going on. Walk us through some of these changes.
Yep. So, of course, the Weighing Machine, we've been doing it for years now. It has been branded CLS as CLS Investments. And what happened is, obviously, CLS has been part of a larger firm called North Star, which had different divisions. We did a big rebrand late last year and kind of a reorganization of all North Star, and we rebranded as Orion. And really, there's still the three primary divisions within Orion. There's Orion Advisor Technology, There's Orion Portfolio Solutions, and then there is CLS Investments, which is an investment management firm, which is basically on the Orion Portfolio Solutions platform, which is a multi-strategist TAMP, which is basically a menu of many different investment strategists and strategies that advisors can pick from. So we're part of Orion Portfolio Solutions, and you know that is how we're it's basically how the whole enterprise is geared towards and what we're trying to support. And so the weighing machine now is going to be branded Orion Portfolio Solutions as opposed to CLS. And the other kind of big twist is that, I mean, the format in a way is still going to be the same. The first half is going to be you and me talking about the markets and interviewing somebody from CLS, talking about something that is hopefully relevant to advisors and investors and help them stay balanced in the current market environment. And then the second part will be an interview. And the twist here will be instead of an interview with somebody who could be a senior executive or maybe an investment professional who's basically fortifying maybe a CLS investment view, is we're actually going to be interviewing people, investment people and personnel that are on the Orion Portfolio Solutions. And so currently there are nearly two dozen different what we call tier one strategists. There's a lot of talent, a lot of really cool strategies, a lot of good opinions. And we just wanted to kind of share a lot of that with listeners. And so that's kind of the format change.
Yeah. All right. Exciting stuff. Okay, so it is award season in the entertainment industry. Oscars are just around the corner. So because it's Kostya and Kostya loves movies, Kostya Ida, Senior Portfolio Manager and Co-Director of Research at CLS, put together a Best Picks of 2019 list for various asset class categories. Let's run through these. First, what got the nod for Best Region?
Yes, you know, Kostya loves his movies. He's always talking about it in every one of his commentaries. We have an internal, we have a morning meeting every day at 8 a.m. Central. And on Fridays, Kostya's always giving us a review of the upcoming movies for the weekend. So that's definitely his thing. We all love movies. In fact, one of our analysts right now is out at Sundance Film Festival right now. So cool. We definitely are a movie crowd. To answer the question, what he gave the nod for Best Region, and the award goes to Emerging Market Europe, which is up over 30% last year. Russia and Greece did have some of the most attractive valuations to start 2019. And investors took advantage of a risk-on environment, and that came through with the strongest returns. Runners up, I guess you could say the nominees for the award but didn't quite win it, were North America, also up just over 30%, and Europe ex United Kingdom.
Kostya also dropped in some 2020 forecasts for each category. Where does he think investors should be paying attention this year?
Well, still in emerging markets, but not emerging market Europe necessarily, but he was talking about Latin America, where most of the countries within the region are attractively valued. He thinks they will benefit from growing commodity prices because of the weaker dollar, potentially weaker dollar, the resurgence of global economic growth, and geopolitical progress.
Who gets the award for Best Country?
Now, Kostya may be Russian, and it's no surprise he picked Russia.
Uh-huh.
Now, he really didn't pick it because of that. It's really the Russian market is driven by four rate cuts from the central bank, reduced fear of sanctions from the U.S. and the EU, a rebound in oil prices, an increase in dividend yields. And despite the outperformance of Russia last year, he does believe it looks still attractive. And quite frankly, it still does when you look at relative valuations. Runner-ups include some areas which have also been beaten down in years past but have been performing better of late, which include Greece and Egypt. It's interesting to note that the U.S. last year seemed to just dominate the world, and again, the S&P 500 looks like it basically did dominate, but it actually was only the ninth best-performing country in the world last year. Pretty interesting. I bet people wouldn't have guessed that.
Mm-hmm.
He also likes to give sort of honorable mention to Mexico, which remains one of the most undervalued countries in the world. It did have a relatively weak year last year, but he believes it will rebound.
How about Best U.S. Factor?
Well, when it comes to factors, the what performed best last year was quality. And quality, again, are companies which there's different definitions of it, but sort of the universal criteria is that they have strong profitability, such as return on equity or return on assets. They have strong balance sheets, which means they don't have a lot of debt. It could also regard to how stable their earnings are over time. And companies, our investors really just liked higher quality companies last year. I think it's partly because even though the market was up, investors were kind of defensive, remarkably, and quality did well, which is really exceptional when you had such a strong year in the market that quality would lead the way. That just really doesn't happen. Runners up last year include Momentum, which would make sense in an upmarket, and minimum volatility, another example of something that shouldn't have done so extraordinarily well in an upmarket. As for the forecast moving forward next year, it's probably not a surprise, but value, which has underperformed in recent years, still looks the most attractive. And so that was his forecast.
Cool. What about best U.S. style box?
So style box is kind of related to the factors a little bit, but it's kind of taking into that, you know, there's that classic style box where you break everything up between large, mid, and small cap companies, and then also value, core, and growth. And what performed best last year was a bit of a surprise. It was actually mid-cap growth stocks. They're up just under 40% last year. I think a lot of people might have a guess, and I would have guessed actually large-cap growth would have won. Again, the risk-on environment last year did drive smaller and mid-sized companies new highs. The runners-up did include, of course, really the S&P 500 sort of names like large-cap growth and large-cap core. And the forecast for next year is small-cap value. Again, value looks cheap. Small-cap looks cheap. You put it all together, small-cap value.
Mm-hmm. Okay, moving on to best U.S. sector.
Technology did best last year, up nearly 50%, best gain since 2009, driven by some of the big tech names like Apple and Microsoft, which make up nearly 40% of the sector. Runners-up included communication services and, surprisingly, financials in the value sector. As for his prediction for 2020, it's not off to a good start as of yet, but energy. And, you know, it really comes down to, again, the relative valuations. Energy over the last 20 years has traded at a slight discount to the overall market. It is now trading at an incredible 40% discount, which is, you know, the biggest discount in a long, long time for that sector.
Final category, best U.S. industry.
Probably not a surprise, given technology did well, that would be a technology industry, and technology hardware and equipment was up over 60%. Like Apple was up nearly 90%. Semiconductor stocks, you know, up nearly 80%. Software up nearly 60%. It was just all kinds of huge numbers. Runner-ups included, you know, actually, I just already included semis. I'm including them as a runner-up. I just gave them mention twice. I just love semiconductors. Honorable mention were banks, up over 40%. And as for his forecast for 2020, oil and gas exploration and production, again, just beaten down, deep values to be had. I just want to say one thing about these comments is that, you know, why we bring this all up is not only to give a market overview for last year, but it really ties in again to what this podcast is about, the weighing machine. So again, as I mentioned, we talk about sentiment, but we also talk about valuations. So really just everything I just mentioned that Kosha mentioned is really talking about longer term valuations, where I think an investor would expect that, you know, the valuations do play out over 5 or 10 years. So I think it's interesting stuff.
Yeah. And that is all from a weekly 3 that Kosha published a couple of weeks ago. So you can check that out in the written version online. And in that same weekly 3, Nick Codola, investment research analyst at CLS, wrote about the courage it takes to be different. He also linked back to the movie theme. There were some unique movies last year that really stood out, some successfully so and others not. He gave a couple examples. 1917, which was a different take on the classic war movie that received a lot of award nominations. And then you have Uncut Gems with Adam Sandler, which is also very different, got totally ignored. So sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. And that's true in our industry too, specifically in the ETF realm. It's a rapidly growing industry, and firms are trying to stand out with their ETF offerings. What was his message there?
Yeah. First of all, Nick is the one that's at Sundance too, so it's not a surprise you talked about movies too. Mm-hmm. Well, anyway, assets and ETFs reached nearly $4.5 trillion at the end of 2019, and 74% of all ETF assets are invested in market cap weighted ETFs. And because of this market cap, indexes are tend to be tilted towards larger, you could arguably argue overvalued companies. And we would kind of classify these as more vanilla exposures where, you know, they're just passive, they're trying to replicate benchmarks. The picture of the ETF industry is, I don't know, it's in the eye of the beholder, but you could say in some ways, in terms of the market exposures themselves, they're kind of just unremarkable and they're biased towards larger companies. There are a lot of interesting ETFs going on and in kind of daring to be different. Of course, smart beta ETFs have grown a lot in recent years, and smart beta ETFs are built around factors such as value or momentum or volatility, some of the things we just talked about earlier. Smart beta ETFs were created not only to help sort of mitigate risk within the marketplace, they're obviously tools that investors think can enhance returns over time. These are not linked to market cap, so they're not linked to sort of these vanilla exposures. So a lot of them tend to be, you know, they have more exposures to mid and small sized companies, for instance. Smart beta ETFs isn't just about equities, though. They also benefit fixed income investors. And in addition to all the smart beta ETFs, there's a lot more actively managed ETFs as well. Again, when we say active, they're just striving to be different than the benchmarks. The industry right now is just over 1% actively managed, and we would expect that actively managed ETFs are going to take a lot more market share in the ETF universe in the years ahead.
Cool. Good stuff. Okay, let's bring in our guest, Orion Director of Investment Due Diligence, Shayna Sissel, calling in from Chicago. Shayna, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So, Shayna, next week you're going to be in Florida giving a presentation at the Inside ETFs conference. Can you give us a preview?
Sure. So I am going to be sitting on a panel that's going to be discussing the use case for liquid alternatives and client portfolios. It's something I'm asked to speak about often because I spent many years doing work showing the analytical case for why alternatives make sense in a diversified portfolio. So it's myself and two others, and we will be bringing different levels of expertise into this very topic. So there will be a gentleman from AGFIQ and Phil Huber with Huber Financial. And we will be discussing with advisors all the many different opportunities there are out there in liquid alternatives, whether it be ETF or mutual fund with a special focus on ETFs, and just how to evaluate them, how to make sense of all the different options that are out there, what you should be looking for when you build out an appropriate allocation to alternatives, and the benefits of doing just that.
All right, good stuff. So let's talk about direct indexing. We've talked about this before, but it's still a new area and there's so much to delve into. Orion sees direct indexing as a significant opportunity for both advisors and investors. In your weekly three coming out this week, you write that our direct index offerings are built on three pillars. Can you talk about those three very important pillars?
Sure. So part of my role here at Orion is co-managing our direct index offerings, and we're really excited about our offering because we think it's truly differentiated from many of our peers. One of the ways that it is differentiated is with our first pillar, which is more access. We believe that no investor should be priced out of personalization, and because we are fortunate enough to include some expertise there with our friends and partners at Orion Technology, we're able to develop technology internally that allows us to automate and reduce the management time and cost, making direct indexing more affordable for investors to have customized and actively managed portfolios. And we're also able to do that at a lower minimum than anywhere else in the industry right now. Our second pillar is transparency. The case for direct indexing really starts with transparency. It allows investors to have a complete look through to what they actually own and not just see a ticker for an ETF on their statement. They know exactly what they own, how much they own, and they know that anytime they want to look at their account. And it should give them confidence in what we're doing, and we're able to really convey the value we bring to the advisors through the way that we manage our direct index products. And from that perspective, it also helps them understand how we are able to achieve the key goal of tax of direct indexing, which is tax loss harvesting and tax savings. Generating tax alpha at the end of the day is the true benefit of direct indexing. And that brings us to pillar number three, which is tax management. Direct indexing provides investors with more tax management than any other vehicle that's out there right now. Because at the end of the day, how much you take home and, you know, every investor's need and tax bracket is different, and being able to customize a solution that works best for them is really the key value proposition for any type of direct index solution. We're able to add Tax Alpha through our process, and again, because we've developed the technology in-house, we're able to do it at lower account minimums than many of our peers. So we're able to offer tax loss harvesting, and for accounts of slightly larger size, $200,000 and up, we're able to also do capital gains budgeting and tax transition planning. So these are things we're really excited about. Right now, we are focusing on what we're calling our beta solutions, which focus almost exclusively on tax loss harvesting. But coming in the spring, we will be rolling out the complete tier structure, which will allow us to also be able to manage for capital gains budgeting and tax transition planning as well.
All right, so keep an eye out for that. As you mentioned at the top of the show, there have been changes instituted throughout the organization here at Orion. And one change has been the One Orion Initiative, which Shayna, you write, has been very positive. What does that change mean for our listeners?
Well, it means that instead of every organization running as their own entity, we're able to leverage each other now as partners under One Orion. And so that allows us to leverage expertise that we couldn't previously leverage. So in this particular case, with the introduction of our new investment strategies group, we're able to take something that was previously outsourced because our organization, FTJ Fund Choice, which is now Orion Portfolio Solutions, didn't have the internal expertise to the extent that they needed to be able to do it in-house. And that is investment due diligence. Previously, FTJ had outsourced this to Rokitan, which is a tremendous organization owned by Goldman Sachs that does really high quality investment due diligence work. But one of the areas which we felt we could do better if we brought it in-house was being able to customize the output for our advisors and also take on more investment due diligence in our process. And so that's part of the reason we made the decision to bring it in-house. I'm leading the effort there, working with Rusty to sort of develop the structure and get everything up and running. By the end of the first quarter, advisors will be able to gain access to our research reports for our Tier 1 global TAMP offerings, as well as get access to our quarterly updates for our Tier 1 global TAMP managers. And we will be doing due diligence on a greater level for our new Orion Communities platform and our Orion Tier 2 offering, which is not necessarily globally available, but available on a broker-dealer by broker-dealer basis. So we're super excited about it. And we really think that we're going to add tons of value for our advisor clients by being able to provide them with truly unique and in-depth insights that they haven't been able to get from us previously.
All right, good stuff. Well, that's going to do it for this portion of the podcast. Shayna, thanks for being on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Next up is Rusty's Q&A, and today he talks to Phil Taze, who's a portfolio manager and chief executive officer of Taze Corporation.
Yep. This is a fun interview, too. Phil and I have known each other for quite some time, and the reason why, again, he's a guest on the Weighing Machine is that Phil is, his firm is one of the leading investment strategists on the Orion Portfolio Solutions and has been working with OPS advisors for years now. He is an expert in a couple different areas, and he talks about some of these areas, and I think there's some really good tidbits here. One is talking about behavioral finance and why it's important to advisors and investors. And also, he is a tactical investment manager, and we do spend some time talking about what that means, how to use it. And I think it's a great interview.
Cool. Let's take a listen.
All right. Well, our guest today on the Weighing Machine is Phil Taze. Welcome, Phil.
Thank you.
Phil and I, we go back many years now. Before I worked at Orion and CLS Investments, Phil spent some time with me in Lincoln, Nebraska on a couple occasions. And so we've shared a few meals, a few drinks, and it's nice to have you on the Weighing Machine.
Thanks, Rusty. Great to be here.
You know, one of the things I want to do kind of in this new reformatted podcast is I want to have walk-up songs. You know how like baseball players walk up to the plate, or, you know, like the startup community a lot of times, when, or TED Talks, when people walk up, they kind of got their walk-up song. And I'm still trying to get permissions here. I know what my walk-up song would be. It's one of my favorite bands is called Radiohead, and they have this song called I Might Be Wrong. And I think it's just the coolest walk-up song. I'm eventually going to have it someplace, somewhere. Phil, what would you have for your walk-up song and why?
You know, I think I'd have to go with I Want to Be Sedated by the Ramones.
The Ramones is awesome.
I just love that. And you know, we all want to be sedated when we're spoken, you know, when we're spoken to at conferences. So it's like a perfect walk-up.
Ah, I like it. And your hair is nothing like Joey Ramone's, though. But we can have all the listeners imagine that right now. No, we won't.
Okay.
Cool.
Great.
Well, Phil, I have a ton of questions for you because you are an expert in a couple of different areas, and I think it'd be really informative to the listeners as well on the podcast. And I have a bunch of questions, so let's get started. And first of all, the first question is, how did you get into the field of tactical asset management?
Way back in the late 80s, I was working for a money management / financial planning firm out in the suburbs of Philadelphia. And it's called the Main Line. It's an area that's considered to be fairly affluent. And this was back in the era of the 250-page financial plans. And we did these plans for all of our pre-retirement retired clients. And they always said that investors needed to have a good chunk of their assets in equities. And the president of this firm and I, as we were contemplating different types of markets, we looked at how long and extensive bear markets could be. And we came to the conclusion that if we'd ever go through one of the worst types of bear markets with our investor base, that our clients would be decimated and we would be decimated and we'd be responsible for their decimation. So we came up all the way back in 89 with the first iteration of a tactical model that was attempting to significantly carve off downside risk.
Yeah. And I can understand the importance of that. I got a bunch of questions on that still. But so in your opinion, why are tactical or risk managed strategies important parts of investor portfolios?
Well, so, you know, if you take that example I just gave of bear markets, right now, our industry right now thinks about worst case scenarios as something like the financial crisis. And even that for investors, if they had a 60-40, 70-30 portfolio and were either about to retire or in retirement, would have had a major impact on people's abilities to sustain themselves through retirement. But it gets potentially worse than that. If you look back at the bear market that we experienced in the Great Depression, that was an 86% decline, and it took about 15 years to recover. So that type of an example is one that would just be life-changing for our clients. And so when we think about risk tactical strategies and risk managed strategies, we think about it as a way to allow portfolios to endure potentially the worst that markets have to offer. And what that means for advisors is that you're able to look your clients in the eye and say, look, their eyes, presumably, they have more than one eye. and say, look, we've prepared these portfolios for what we think are the worst that the markets have to offer. And so, you know, it helps reduce anxiety. It helps address these scenarios that we're not thinking about so much because we had 11-year advance. But it tries to add an insurance-like level of, I don't want to say protection because the compliance people will be after us, but a way of trying to create a floor underneath markets and address these worst case scenarios.
Yeah. Do you know, I feel, I agree with everything. I mean, when it comes to tactical strategies, the real value to them, in my opinion, it really comes down to the behavioral aspects. And I know you're going to talk about some of that coming up. But it's really the goal for investors is it isn't about beating the market. It's about being in the market. And it's really about beating the bank. So if it takes a tactical strategy to stay involved and to participate in the market, that's going to result in better investor results over time. And they're going to be more likely to reach their goals. Now, you have a lot of really cool strategies and very unique strategies that are very different from what most money managers are doing. Could you, and you have a lot of them, could you talk about a few of those strategies kind of in talking point form that are available on the Orion Portfolio Solutions platform?
Yeah, absolutely. So really, it's easy to do because it fits into three categories. One of them is what we call our unconstrained tactical group of models, and we're changing that terminology to call them high conviction tactical models. These strategies are designed to very simply be allocated into equities and index-like products during rising periods. But they have several different mechanisms for attempting to uncorrelate from the markets if they turn lower. And so these strategies ideally will get somewhere between 70 and 90% up capture if they're functioning like they should during rising periods. But they attempt to exit in the very early stages of declines and be on the sidelines or in aggregate bonds or cash during declining markets. So that's the first category. The second category is that same type of exiting or defensive algorithm but applied to high-yield bonds. That's our most popular type of strategy on the ops platform. And so when it's bullish, it's in high-yield bonds. If high-yield bonds turn lower, it's designed to attempt to exit and be in cash instruments. So that is a great way to just increase yields in your fixed income allocations. It's a mandate-free strategy, but also potentially, we think, address risks from interest rates or inflation. And the third type of category is a hybrid of our unconstrained tactical model, and it's an equity strategy called Defensive Alpha. It's designed to be in index blend types of products during rising periods. When markets turn lower, it reacts not by going to cash, but by going to defensive stocks. And we do that by buying into something that looks very much like the S&P Low Vol Index. And so that's a way to get index participation, have some loss avoidance, but not a complete uncorrelation, but help to reduce drawdown for these mandate one strategies.
Great. I like it. And again, like I said, these are definitely unique and definitely offering something different that you just can't find on the platform otherwise. I also really like the word conviction. I feel that if somebody is actively managing a portfolio or tactically managing a portfolio, that obviously conviction needs to be an important part of it. So I think that's neat. Mm-hmm. That's captured in the title. Okay, so let's do a hypothetical exercise. Let's say you cannot invest in your own risk-managed fund, but you have to shop for one. What key characteristics would you look for when seeking a risk-managed strategy or tactical strategy yourself? What do you think are the important elements of a good tactical strategy?
So this is a real riddle, and it's very difficult for advisors to grasp this. And here's one of the reasons. You've got up capture and then loss avoidance. And what we found is if you look at strategies that do very well during rising markets, some of them may not have as robust or effective loss avoidance structures. So what you can do then is be tricked into allocating to something that has full up capture. And what we joke among ourselves at our company about having risk management strategies that are designed for rising markets. So there are a couple of things I'd look for. The first is I'd look for something, especially if it's tactical, that is very quick to react. We'd all like to think that we have a sign on I-95 that says losses are coming ahead, act now, but it never happens that way. And if you look at the history of declines, sometimes they play out very quickly. The quickest we would reference would be 1987. And if I would look at the maybe 50 different tactical, unconstrained tactical strategies on the marketplace right now, I'd say that probably 35 to 40 of these 50 strategies move quite slowly out of the markets and might even have been captured by something like 1987. So quick to move. Number two, avoid predictive strategies. Once at this prior firm, we tried to predict the markets and not follow our system. That didn't work out well. The market stretched away from us by 20%. And what you find when you're in the tactical industry is that predicting markets over the short term is almost impossible. So as you're looking and evaluating a system, try to find something that is more price reactive. It's only watching the price of an asset class. And what you get then, you may get some underperformance trades and some situations where you're being, get some little whipsaws. But what it also brings is a lot of reliability around loss avoidance. And the third thing I would say to advisors out there is avoid do-it-yourself tactical. I've seen hundreds of advisors attempt to it. Only about one or two have done it successfully. And if you're in a situation where you're making big bets for bond portfolios yourself and trying to defend that to your client base, and you go through periods where you're underperforming, as you inevitably will, we can create some substantial client retention issues. So those would be the three things I'd look at.
Oh, that was juicy. I liked it. You know, so I find, I find when it talks about tactical strategies that people kind of have different definitions, and you kind of touched upon a couple of those things. I mean, to me, there's really a couple different ways of looking at tactical strategies. And for somebody who's shopping for a tactical strategy, has to really decide what they're really looking for. And one of those attributes is something that can dramatically adjust a portfolio's asset allocation or risk allocation. And obviously that's part of it. But the second part of it, and this is actually, I think, probably maybe different investors emphasize it a little more strongly than others, but it is that loss avoidance that you're talking about and that downside protection. So are you looking for a tactical strategy to do well over a full market cycle? Or are you looking for it to do really well in those down markets? And I think you really have to compare and contrast that way. The other thing which you hit upon, which I think is so huge, is that when there's market volatility and there's losses, it becomes so emotional. And you need to have something that is rules-based. And I've seen many tactical strategies over the years where they don't have those rules. And, oh my gosh, they just sort of flap around in the wind sometimes. And they're trigger-happy. And ultimately their performance just isn't great over time. So I think the rules-based, that discipline, is crucial as well. All right, so.
Yeah, and if you're making those trades too, your life is miserable. Because that's all you're thinking about is how the market happens not to be going against you. And every other day it's not going for you. So anyway, yeah,
great.
I couldn't agree.
Yeah, you nailed that too. Great point. All right, so how do you recommend investors use their strategies? And should they be blending them with other strategies? What's your general guidance in terms of how to use the TAE strategies?
So yeah, that's awesome. So we spend a lot of time and have spent a lot of time thinking about and evaluating and creating pathways for advisors. And we have something that we refer to as our whole portfolio recommendation. And it fits, it's lines up a lot with what you see on the ops platform. But what we recommend is that at least 50% of an equity portfolio should be in long only, high beta, potentially even just passive strategies that move along with the market. And that's vital because if you have tactical strategies, they inevitably will go through periods where they're trailing markets. And you want to make sure that you're satisfying the investor need to be participating in market growth through pretty much all markets. So that's number one. Then take the other 50% and put it into something that has the ability, as we've been discussing, to uncorrelate from the markets. When you're doing modeling, advisors, they like to look at the risk measure of max drawdown. And that's a really clear way when you're trying to evaluate what you want to put into your portfolio to size up how different strategies fit within what you're trying to accomplish for an investor. By having an unconstrained tactical model for about 50% of your equity, it's a game changer for drawdown. And you can take a 70-30 portfolio from a max drawdown of something like 37% and bring it all the way down to more like in the low 20s. And we all know that's much easier for investors to endure. So with all of these unconstrained and tactical models, we recommend pairing them up with things that are more conventional, long only, and at least with that other part that's not in tactical, embracing French and FAMA and efficient markets.
Yep. again, and there's not a lot of tension here because I'm basically agreeing with basically everything you're saying. So it is key to diversify different strategies, particularly in different market environments. So I totally agree. You need to have kind of those beta exposures that participate in the market. You need the active and tactical managers to help you through those choppier times. And of course, you need diversifiers depending on your risk tolerance to adequately kind of control the overall portfolio risk. And that gets me to my next point. When it comes to risk tolerance, it is, you know, really it's about an investor's not only their financial capacity for risk and their what their financial goals are, but it's really their emotional capacity for risk. And it's also, it's really about their investor behavior. You've done a ton of work and you have a ton of resources for advisors regarding behavioral investing. And I know that you're launching the Behavioral Investing Institute this quarter. So what is the institute and why do you think it's important for advisors?
Advisors might feel or think that because we've all experienced the financial crisis, assuming you've been in business that long, that we're able to understand risk in a way that we didn't before and navigate it more efficiently. But I'd argue that for most advisors, the communication construct and our ability to help guide investors through turbulent markets like that hasn't changed. And that if we would experience something like that again, we'd find ourselves in very much the same state of an inability to address the feeling of panic and prevent investors from doing exactly the wrong thing. And my colleague Evan Burr and I identified this back in 2011 and began creating content that would help advisors help investors navigate these kinds of markets. So we've been doing that now for approaching a decade, and we are creating the Behavioral Investing Institute to formalize some of these tools and procedures for advisors. And so, you know, if you look at what's happening in the marketplace right now, which is that many of the advisory functions are being automated, like rebalancing, tax reporting, even portfolio allocations and questionnaires, and there are robos out there that do that. But why we think this is so important for advisors is that this is the one area where if you could change up the communications construct in a way that allowed you to proactively address some of these behavioral challenges that investors experience and manage them through it in a way that they can continue to have peace of mind, it's potentially the biggest value that you can add to your investors. And so we think it's the big wide open space where advisors can get a lot of traction right now.
Yeah. Again, gosh, I'm trying to be a contrarian. It's just so hard with you, Phil. But the you're absolutely right. The behavioral stuff is all. I mean, we obviously manufacture rates of return being portfolio managers, but you know, really for investors to succeed, it's all the other stuff that surrounds that, and it's kind of it is the behavioral stuff. I mean, there are various studies out there from different firms, and they all kind of come to the same conclusion that most of the value add from a financial advisor is really sort of in that making sure investors stay disciplined, and that's obviously kind of like talking through those tough market environments. So how did you get in the field of behavioral finance yourself?
So if you look at the return profiles of our different models, you'd have to conclude that they've done pretty much exactly what they were supposed to. Which is, you know, generally participate in market gains, but not generally participate in market falls. And that's great. But when we did a study back in 2010, we discovered that the average investor had a very different experience. They had 7% lower returns than the models themselves. Why? Because they were all perpetually buying into our strategies after big decline when risk management wasn't as needed as much, and selling after big rallies. And so, you know, Rusty, we concluded that for our business was perfectly wrong timing. And when we opened up this box and looked at the rest of the industry, what we discovered is the whole asset management industry is out there selling the things that have five stars and just did very well, and buying the things that and selling the things that just did very poorly with perfectly bad timing. So that's when we began back in 2011 creating this content. We said, if we don't do something, we're going to just experience the same thing. And even though we might be running models that are performing well, our investors aren't really benefiting from it. And I know from back when we first met back in Lincoln, you were telling a story of how you created a former RIA you were with, a whole process of investing in things that just did poorly. So you were smart enough to realize that that was going on and work counter to trends. And so you obviously had some ability to manage your investors in that process as well.
Yeah. Boy, that's a good old story. Yeah, the it just a quick aside on that. I mean, it's probably the one number that most investors pick a fund on, whether we're talking individual investors, institutional investors, the financial media. Everybody seems to like look at a 3-year number, thinking that it's like it's sufficiently long enough to capture something. But the interesting thing about a 3-year number, which probably, again, if there's a single number that drives most of the flows in the industry, that's probably it. The only thing is that 3-year number has a negative correlation with future performance, which is the amazing thing about it. So, and another thing too is that you nailed on the head is tactical strategies, good strategies. If, you know, if an advisor or an investor truly doesn't understand why she or he is using it, they might look at the return stream and say, this thing is up there just swinging for the fences, hitting home runs or striking out. And that, if they're thinking that, they're not really understanding the process and how the tactical strategies are fitting into the overall portfolio. Okay, so how do you feel the Orion Portfolio Solutions platform lines up with your behavioral finance advice?
So we're very lucky that the platform where we have the biggest portion of our assets lines up perfectly with our advice. Because if you look at what we're saying, is we're saying you need to have long-only equities, risk-managed tactical equities, and then some kind of a adjustable or tactical fixed income or diversifier types of strategies. And those fit perfectly within the ops framework. So when we talk to ops advisors and help guide them how to use our portfolios, it just fits perfectly within the proposal system. So there's no conflict. And I think that by creating these categories, it really makes it clear. You can't, if you just have a 15 investments in your portfolio, but there's no understanding of what the role, what their role is in that portfolio, it just becomes a bunch of numbers. It just becomes a table and it's meaningless. So the way Orion builds that out and segregates it leads you to a pathway where you can implement some of these behavioral and investment management tools.
Yeah. All right, so we've just been talking about discipline and rules-based, taking emotions out of it, and not being judgmental and qualitative. So because of that, I have to ask you, what is your current assessment of the markets? And when it comes to the markets, what makes you most excited about the future and the current market environment, and what gives you the most concern or pause? There are just actually like five questions in one.
I love that. I love those questions because there was a great book written by a former PIMCO executive called The Keynesian Endpoint, and it's a fascinating conversation. Here we've been now as a developed societies in this environment where debt has begun to be perceived as benign, and so we have record levels of debt when you consider globally, when you look at government, corporate and private debt. Governments seem to feel that there's an invincibility, that there's little or no harm to increasing debt levels. And I think ultimately what we're going to discover is that that is not the case, and that debt is as perilous on a global level as it is for individuals in their own personal lives. And so I think it's a world of contrast right now, where you've got a bull market and everything is it looks great, and one of our critical things that we've identified that investors need to feel in their portfolios that they're participating with the markets. So you have a need to be in the markets right now and be participating. But I think that it would help advisors to understand that we're in new territory globally with debt, and that it's imperative that you bring to bear parts of the portfolio that can dislocate from economic activity. And included in, among those things that you need to watch out for is the potential for some kind of unprecedented inflation as a result of high debt levels or currency crises. So all of that built into this. So I'm not really worried about anything for us, because what we do as a firm is we try to guide investors and advisors to think about all different types of scenarios and then build portfolios for these worst case scenarios. And so for us, the more we see markets stretch higher, the better it is, because we're just at the moment, we're just fully invested across our platform, but our trailing exit levels continue to move higher. So potentially, you know, if we see this rally continue for another year, and then it really moves lower and we have some crisis on the other end, we'll potentially lock in some of these gains and then have great relative performance on the other side of it. I do worry for conventional investors, though, and for many advisors who are losing a need to bring risk management strategies to bear, or who are choosing risk management strategies that are maybe less effective, because I think that all longer time horizon, it could be potentially quite dire.
Yeah,
I could go on and on, but I'll stop.
You know, it's interesting you talk about the debt, because obviously, you know, debt, it seems to be behind really all the big periods of severe market crisis and stress. And, you know, it's like in history, we learn, we just don't learn. And it's kind of like investors have sort of already forgotten those lessons already. All right, so you did talk about debt. So this kind of ties into, obviously, you have been very successful in managing a tactical high yield strategy. So we're talking about debt and then thinking about the high yield market right now. And then talking about also the very bottom of investment grade. So that whole area, there's just a ton of bonds in that space now. And some market observers think this is the thing that scares them the most about the current market environment. What do you think about corporate bonds, particularly high yield bonds right now?
I think it fits into the scenario that I was talking about with equities and with debt and global markets generally, is that right now it continues to be really the best story out there for fixed income and for yield.
Mm-hmm.
So you have got this divergent these two divergent perspectives. On one hand, if you're in investment grade bonds and you subtract from that yield inflation and taxes and fees, you're living at this moment in a negative return environment. And that's a negative return, real return that also has risk associated with it of potential for rising interest rates and inflation. So that's not a great starting place. And so a way to address that is to move up the yield curve. And many people are doing that. The problem with that is, as we all know, that high yield bonds can act as a proxy for equities. And so if you see a downturn in the economy or recessions, or for whatever reason, the stock market moves lower, high yield bonds reflect that, and these higher yield bonds. And so And then in addition to that, there are many other issues that I'm sure you're thinking about, Rusty, that include the quality of covenants with higher yielding bonds, and the fact that that's much lower than it was a decade ago, and then the potential for liquidity issues.
Mm-hmm.
So these adaptive fixed income strategies like tactical high yield allow you to have some pragmatic solutions to this. In other words, yes, you do want to try to increase yields up to the point where you have real positive returns, but you do also, you need to simultaneously not forget about the risks associated with it. And so I think that's one of the reasons that these strategies for us are so popular on the OPS platform, is because advisors are seeing that. And it's a way to navigate this, what I think is a fairly complex and precarious situation.
You know, again, it's fixed income is important to portfolios because, in general, because it's a way to manage risk, because it just doesn't make sense for all investors to be 100% equities. And I think because interest rates are so low that an active or tactical approach to fixed income makes a lot of sense. So I can understand the popularity behind your strategy and why it's been, again, so popular on the OPS platform. All right, so we've talked about advisors a lot, and you've been working with advisors for a long time yourself. In your opinion, what do you think makes a good financial advisor? And if you were shopping for a financial advisor, what would you look for?
You know, we talk to all types of advisors, the billion-dollar plus advisors, you know, smaller broker-dealer types advisors that have 20 to 50 million. And you might be surprised by this answer, Rusty, but I would actually seek out a not huge advisor, someone that is able to make bold decisions. And some big advisors are so intimidated by underperforming the market, and they have big research teams, and they're basically just trying to conform to what the markets are doing. So I'd search for an advisor that does two things. Number one is a student of the markets, and you could tell that based on their knowledge of both investment products and the markets generally. But also, I'd want to find someone that focused on a client-centric approach to building portfolios, someone that was willing to eschew the desire to chase benchmarks and to build strategies and portfolios around my specific needs and my goals, and who is comprehensive in their risk management approach. Because what I absolutely would not want to do is lose a lot of money because it just happened to have bad time with the markets.
So again, if I heard it correctly, the key word there was conviction. You know, having a financial advisor with conviction in the way she or he is conducting their business and advising on portfolios. Okay, let's twist it a little bit here. So what do you think makes a good investment management client?
Well, you know, I don't know if you remember back in the day, Rusty, when mutual fund statements were sent out, and this is before fee-based platforms. And they would come out maybe just quarterly or annually. They would show the number of shares and then somewhere on the statement, the price of the share, but they wouldn't go to the trouble of multiplying the two to show you what the value of your account was. So I'm a senior now, but, that was almost a perfect statement because, and unless, an investor got out their calculator and, did the math, they wouldn't even know what the value of their investment was, whether it had gone up or down. And what a perfect way to not be alarmed by a downturn in the markets. So, you know, we now are required for compliance reasons to send out quarterly statements and to constantly be keeping investors abreast. And many people are also interested in showing benchmarks and what the relative performance is. But, you know, the investors that I know that have had the best results are the ones that are able to just focus maybe once a year and talk to their advisor. If there are any decisions that need to be made, make them then, have a lot of confidence in their advisor and what they're doing, and then forget about it. So the best investment management clients are able to completely detach and trust the decisions they've made are good and just not even care about what happens in the markets.
Bam, you nailed it. And you know what? That is exactly true. I've even just in the last week, I came across another situation of an investor whose portfolio you would say, you know, it wasn't necessarily awesome, but the reason why they were so successful and built such wealth over time is because she trusted her advice. And I don't know how many times that has happened where, you know, I've got all this fancy investment, sophisticated knowledge and type stuff. And then some of the people who have the best results don't have the most optimized portfolios, but what they have is they trust their advisor and it just works over time. I do disagree with one comment though you said though. Finally, we've got a disagreement here. And, you know, given that given that, we're all living longer and everybody listening to this podcast is going to live a lot longer too. You know, I have heard you're not a senior. Well, you're still middle-aged until you're 60 years old. So you called yourself a senior, which would make me a senior. So I don't know what the heck you're talking about. So, all right.
Yeah. So at 56, I find I'm always the oldest guy around in whatever environment. So I don't know.
Yeah. Well, all right. So you did do something here a little while ago, which kind of got me by surprise because I can't believe I didn't know this. And first of all, I do still read tons of books on the markets. And actually, I buy even a lot more to make people I read even more than I do. But you did mention a title I didn't know. And that was, I think you said Keynesian Endpoints. I'm guessing it was by Paul McCauley or something. I'm not sure who the author was.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, I would have guessed that. But so what else are you reading right now? Do you have any good book recommendations?
Well, I'll keep it business focused. In the last year, the most interesting book I read was a book called The Talent Code by Daniel Coyle. And I think it's worth a read. It applies not just to our business lives, but our personal lives. And in this book, he, I think, fairly successfully debunks this notion that geniuses are born. And he walks through examples of people throughout history and examines what was happening in their informative years and creates a pathway for helping us understand that by doing just certain types of things, almost anyone can become an expert tennis player or soccer player or portfolio manager or investment advisor or someone that's regarded as a genius by following this certain pathway. So I think that's a fascinating read.
The only thing bad about that is you just made me have to buy another book. Okay.
Okay.
My reading list is expanding. That's awesome. Where can listeners learn more about your firm?
If you've been paying attention to the behavioral investing part, I think that might be the most interesting thing that you should search for. And we offer our coaching program to investment advisors. So go to TAWSCorp.com, TOEWSCORP.com, and click on the advisor training section there. And it'll give some information about our behavioral coaching program for advisors. And I think that would be a good place to start.
Awesome. Well, Phil, any closing words? I really appreciate your time today.
Yeah. The closing words I would have would be 11 years into a bull market is to really think about all types of markets. I think we're certainly in a higher valuation or the top quintile of valuations across fixed income and equities right now. Make sure you're focused on some kind of risk management within your portfolios, because now is the time when it's going to be most important to have that in what you're offering.
Good stuff. Phil, thanks again, and you will definitely be back.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks so much.
Talk to you later.
All right, good stuff. That's going to do it for this week. Rusty, take us out with your final thoughts.
Stay balanced and stay the course.
We'll be back in a couple of weeks. Thanks for listening to The Weighing Machine, and thank you for your time and trust in Orion Portfolio Solutions. The Weighing Machine is hosted by Rusty Vanneman, Chief Investment Officer at Orion Advisor Solutions, and me, Robin Murray, freelance writer and editor. It is produced by Kevin Cleaver. If you have feedback or questions about our podcast today, please send us a note at rusty@orion.com.